shrinks, bonuses grow, and some jobs don't go to Mexico.
804 more announcements just like that to equal the standard of jobs in the manufacturing sector that were created in this country under President Obama's watch.
Ask the American people. By 2-1, they want careers, not jobs. A job is 9-5. A job is Starbucks.
The Democrats should stop talking about raising the minimum wage. People don't want to earn the minimum
right.
wage.
But I do believe there's an opportunity here. And I think that Trump and his administration will be able to find ways to drive policies and incentives to get employers hiring again.
I think what's happening right now, people are recognizing that we're probably going to get faster than expected growth. The economic malaise is going to be over in a Trump administration. The implementation of both a personal income tax and a corporate income tax cut is going to realize a lot of earnings growth.
Now all eyes turn to the Federal Reserve and whether it will raise interest rates in December.
This is real, and we're not trapped in a matrix-like experiment to see how humans survive a Trump presidency.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, that rally was just cut a little bit short after reaching some record levels. We've got the Dow Jones Industrial Average up for the week, but the other averages, with the exception of transportation, aren't following the Dow. We have some negatives here, especially as we take a look at the S&P, the Russell and the smaller cap indexes. We got a good employment report on Friday with some jobs created and the unemployment rate falling. But will that translate into higher stock prices and the Santa Claus rally continue to the rest of the year? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Dave Nikoski will be joining me in hour one. He thinks that we're probably due for a consolidation here, but he thinks this market is going much higher, and this bull has some strong legs, but he thinks the real key to making money is not just indexing or investing in the averages, it's getting into the right sectors as we're seeing massive sector rotation. Dave will be here to talk about it. Robert Rapier will be joining me later on in the program as we take a look at this OPEC cut in production for the first time in years. OPEC managed to get together and cut 1.2 million barrels. Will they follow through? He thinks they will, and he also thinks that further cuts are coming. We'll be talking about that with him and the prospects for energy in the months and year ahead. He thinks energy prices have bottomed. They're heading higher. He's still sticking to a $60 prediction for oil prices by the end of the year. We'll talk about that. And of course, Chris Sheridan will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All that coming up in hour number one.
And I'm John Loeffler here. You know, the conditions when President Bush and President Obama assumed office are somewhat radically different than those economically and even geopolitically when President-elect Trump will assume office. When President Bush came in, he changed the military. We did have 9-1-1 then, the Iraq War, and then we also cut taxes and changed rather pronouncedly what happened in the markets and the economy. President Obama came in, raised taxes, raised regulation, and in essence stifled the economy, and that's why it's so crippled right now. Now President Trump will come in, and he's saying all of this doesn't work, especially assuming our 1% GDP growth rate where we are right now. So what are the headwinds that Mr. Trump is going to face, because he is determined here to have a Trumpian revolution? What do we expect to see geopolitically, economically, and of course then, what does this mean for investments? That's going to be the subject of conversation today on The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Chris Sheridan is sitting in today for Ryan Poplava for the market wrap-up, and thanks for joining us this week while Ryan is out. Now, before we get into the wrap-up report for the week's driving news, just off the top of your head, what would you say the most interesting thing you discussed on Financial Sense Insider this week was? I've got my hand raised, but I'm not going to put my two cents in it. What was the most interesting interview, so people who don't listen to the Insider series will know what you're up to?
Well, John, of course, every show that we do is interesting, so it's really hard to rate them.
And he's very, very humble, you know.
Right. So we spoke to Andrew Zatlin of Moneyball Economics on Wednesday, and we talked about why he's still leaning bearish. And he listens to a lot of the different comments that come from corporate executives in terms of earnings reports and what their thinking is from the bottom up in terms of how Trump's presidency is going to play out. And he's really thinking that a lot of the effects that we've seen on the market so far, this exuberant market reaction to Trump's election, is investors getting ahead of themselves, and that a lot of Trump's policies are probably not going to be taking effect until the second half of 2017. So he is still sticking to his calls for sluggish economic growth, and particularly when we head into the first half of 2017 is when he thinks we're going to see some pickups in layoffs. So that was a very interesting interview. We went into a lot of different things. The Leaning Tower of San Francisco, since he's actually based there in San Francisco, we discussed that a little bit. And so that's been in the news here and there. And then on Thursday, we talked to macro ops Tyler Kling about the bond market peaking. He does think, in alignment with Ray Dalio and many others, Jeff Gundlach, Stan Druckenmiller, that the bond market has probably peaked. When we spoke to him last in June, actually, of this year, that was something that he had said, is that bond investors were facing some pretty clear asymmetrical risks. And lo and behold, rates bottom. We saw the all-time low just weeks after we spoke with him. I believe that was in July. So that was a very good interview. We got an update from him on the bond market and why he thinks the U.S. dollar is going to head higher. So he had a lot of interesting remarks. And then lastly, we spoke to Riva Gujan at Stratfor on Friday about why she thinks that 2017 is going to be a very tumultuous year, given the elections that we're going to see, not only in Europe, but with the Trump presidency now, how that's going to play out in terms of foreign policy and trade. So there was a lot of topics that we discussed on that interview Friday.
All of that being a motivation for listeners to subscribe to the series. I know I always find it interesting. I'm looking forward to the one you're going to be doing on human longevity and why that factors into economic things, because that's a whole area of research right now. Anyway, the important thing to realize about the series, I know we need to get on with the market thing here, but it really is helpful when your expert guests get more than just a quick soundbite opportunity like you do on the TV channels. I'm always frustrated because people don't get a chance except to blurt out something, and that's the moment they do it. And if they don't do it, it doesn't get done. And that's why it's really good to have some kind of an in-depth interview, because you come away with a really good picture. All right, turning to the markets this week, seems like equities in the S&P 500 took a breather after the post-election run for the first time, but it doesn't really look like bears are really pressing the advantage right here. So what's giving them pause on this anyway?
Well, John, there was a lot of economic news that came out this week, and I would say it was pretty positive. Most of the economic news was on the positive side, and the big, big issue that really moved the markets this week was OPEC finally coming out and making an official agreement to cut production. That was the really big news item this week, which many of you have probably heard about on the news, and there was a lot of back and forth between Iran and Saudi Arabia over the past 2 months, but Saudi Arabia finally realized that by allowing Iran to cut less than the rest of its members, that it was going to be far beneficial for them if an agreement was really made, given that they have such a need for higher prices, and also because of their goals in privatizing Saudi Aramco. If we see higher oil prices, then that's really going to help them capitalize that IPO. So I would say that's the motivations for why finally we saw a cut there. In terms of the big news events, that was probably the thing that moved the needle the most.
Why do you think Iran finally caved anyway?
Well, it's possible that a Trump administration instead of a Clinton administration played a role on that. Based on some of the comments that Trump has made about bringing back sanctions and ripping up Obama's nuclear deal on day one in the office. So I think that's some of the speculation that we see now in terms of why Iran really finally caved in there.
Okay, so OPEC stabilized prices, oil's headed up, and I've been hearing that drilling companies are hiring again like crazy. And the question would be, is this going to be beneficial for the economy? I'm going to guess it is for jobs.
But job growth is certainly good. The only concern a rise in energy prices brings with it is a rise in inflationary expectations. And that's what we're seeing now. After the OPEC announcement, 10-year Treasury note yields hit a fresh high above 2.4%. And that's quite a climb that we've seen just recently, particularly after the Trump win. They're now up about a percentage point when we look at the 10-year. So if oil rises too fast, the concern is that could spark inflation even higher, and then we could see a more aggressive Fed, which could stifle growth further. So there's that feedback relationship there. So far, it's too soon to come to that conclusion yet, as inflation pressures are really still below the Fed's annual target of 2%. But that's something that we need to watch. How far oil prices can move up. We don't want them going too far too fast. And then the same thing with Treasury yields with respect to inflationary expectations. So those are some of the key things that people are keeping on their radar.
Well, since I mentioned job growth, I guess we should discuss what you think of this week's job reports. As much as I'm always suspicious of these numbers, and sometimes they don't seem to represent the real world, but there was a nice drop in the unemployment rate, right?
Yes, that's right. The unemployment rate dropped from 4.9% to 4.6%, but largely as a result of the participation rate dropping a tenth of a percent. So the job increase was at 178,000, which was largely in line with expectations. However, average hourly earnings dropped and the manufacturing work week dropped as well. So in my opinion, it's good the jobs report wasn't overly bullish, as there's been some concern, given the rise in GDP and wage inflation, that the Fed might have to be more aggressive in early 2017 with rate increases. And so that's what we don't want to see. We don't want the Fed now getting behind the curve and having to raise quicker than anticipated. So again, everything points towards an increase in December. The Fed funds futures market is really putting it at 100% or just barely under that. So the market is definitely expecting a rate hike to occur this December. But then again, the key thing is we don't want the outlook with inflation to get too hot to the point where policy would dictate a change from this very gradual normalization process. And I think that's why we saw Treasury rates come down a bit towards the end of the week.
Well, we have a referendum coming up in Italy in the extremely near future, like within the coming week. I know Nigel Farage was on Fox Business talking about that this week. Seems like European stocks have been in decline here ahead of the December 4th vote to stay or leave the European Union. And of course, the question is this going to be a trend having gone through the Brexit vote already?
That's right, John. And that's been in despite of some decent economic numbers coming out of Europe. The Purchasing Manager Index comes out mid and at the end of the month. And while it was unchanged at 53.7, that's the highest it's been since January 2014. But uncertainty always worries investors. And that's what we see with this Italian referendum that is taking place December 4th, this Sunday. So we'll know more next week. But even then, look at what happened with the Brexit vote and the rally that commenced after that. So even when we see something that is unexpected and a shock, and even when the experts are saying, oh, this is going to be terrible, like most were thinking with Trump as well, the market will often behave in a very unpredictable manner.
Well, as we round out today for the weekend, Chris, is there anything else you'd like to add, especially things you might find interesting?
Yes, we heard a few words from the president-elect's nominees this week, including the Treasury Secretary nominee, Steve Mnuchin, who said he wants corporate tax cuts and bank reform to allow for less stringent requirements and more lending. Wilbur Ross, for Commerce Secretary, wants to relook at tariffs and what he called dumb trade agreements. So it is definitely going to be an interesting administration next year. I think we can say that the least. A lot of changes that are going to be taking place. There's going to be plenty to discuss, and we're starting to get more and more research coming in discussing the possibilities for how this next administration is going to play out in 2017. And this is definitely going to be giving me on the Insider podcast during the week, and Ryan and here on the weekend show, plenty to work with for our listeners.
Okay, Chris Sharon, I appreciate you sitting in for Ryan Paplava. It's going to be interesting. I just think for December, a lot of times news sort of slows down in December, but for some reason, enough interesting things, both economically and politically, seem to be coming down the roll to keep us all interested. Have a good weekend.
You too, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Paplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888- 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us on the program is CPA and tax specialist Kim Fischera. Kim, let's get through some of the particulars of taxes for 2016, since, you know, we've got a little bit over a month. I know for only a month left, there's probably not too many things that you can do to lower taxes. But what I'm looking at is a new president, a Republican-controlled Congress, where one of the top priorities is going to be tax reform, and that would involve playing around with deductions and lowering tax rates to 33%. So let's talk about some of the obvious things that this might imply. One, let's assume there is no tax change. And then number two, what would be done differently if there is tax reform as proposed by either Trump or Congress? So what should be done around this time of the year?
Well, Jim, it's nice to be with you again. I always enjoy talking with you. Of course, I always dread this time of year as we move into tax season. Things are going to get pretty busy for us. But there's still a lot people can still do between now and the end of the year. We have a full month, and we get fairly busy in December with clients that need to do tax planning. Typically, people that have businesses or have a lot of variations in their income come to see us. And, you know, what people typically do is try to basically accelerate deductions and defer income. You know, find ways to increase their ability to write things off this year, especially with, you know, the tax brackets right now go up to 39.6% for federal. So there's an incentive to try to defer income. And the first thing that somebody needs to do is to do a tax projection and determine where they're at right now for 2016. And then once that's done, then you can start looking at, you know, what are the opportunities, the variables, the various options that they might have between now and the end of the year to hopefully reduce taxes.
Well, another record-breaking week for the markets. Just when you think things were going to go down on the election, they've gone in the opposite direction. But we're seeing some things that we haven't seen in a while. We not only have record prices on the major stock indexes, but we also have rising interest rates, a rising dollar, and rising oil. Let's try to make sense of that all. Joining me on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave, let's talk about something that we're seeing right now that we haven't seen in quite some time. You've got rising interest rates along with new records in the stock market. You've got a rising dollar and you've got rising oil prices. I'd like to get your perspective. Why are we seeing all four of these go up at the same time?
Well, I think it's a sign that investors do appreciate that the U.S. is making changes. And I think the election caught many people off guard. You know, we look back in time and try to look at other periods of time and compare it to today as technicians. And one of the things that stands out to me, and I can't make everything perfectly aligned, but, you know, post-World War II, the markets reversed and broke out to new highs right around the 45-46 period. You raced up into later part of 49 and had a pullback, but you were still marking new highs in the index and you had a timeout and then a further advance, which started a secular bull market. And at that period, we don't have good information on what the U.S. dollar was doing because we don't have a U.S. dollar index. But one thing that stood out during that time is interest rates were climbing, and that was a sign of the post-war growth, the building boom. Again, we can't compare that to today, or at least I can't come up with information that would suggest that. But if what we're seeing come out of the new administration that's going to be coming into office, it certainly seems like they're going to be advocates for corporations here. Rather than see more and more businesses leave, it looks like they're going to do whatever they can to keep jobs in this country. And I think that's probably a welcome sight, especially when over the last 30 years, we've seen a number of businesses leave the country. to answer the question, can you have a rising interest rate and the markets move up? Yes. When it comes to the U.S. dollar, whenever we look back in time, historically, any market that breaks out to a bull market is contrived of a strong dollar. And so I think having the strong dollar is a welcome sign. But, you know, I think in the short term, we're significantly overbought in the dollar. And I think we're significantly oversold in the bonds. And I think that we just have to have a timeout and consolidate some of the gains that we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
I look at the market sometimes in a fundamental sense, because a rising dollar does hurt earnings for U.S. multinational corporations like we see in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But one of the things that's happening, as you know, Dave, earnings have been down for several quarters. What is that? 4 or 5 quarters. But if energy prices start to rise, we can see a significant increase in S&P earnings that can come from the energy and materials sector alone. So if prices rise, you could see an earnings increase, which is one thing that has been lacking over the last year.
I think when you look back at the period in January when oil prices came through the $40 a barrel level, you saw the financial sell-off extremely hard. Most of them marking, you know, multi-year lows in some of the financial names. What's interesting is now you've had a surge coming off that $26, $27 level in crude oil, and we're sitting here north of 51. And obviously with interest rates rising as well, you're seeing the financials start to appreciate that, you know, they may see some higher yield in their loan portfolios. And I think that those are welcome signs, and we should see higher increased earnings within the financials, who at this point don't have to worry about writing off as much bad debt as they did from the oil energy sector that they were looking at in January. And I think that's why investors sold them off. So I think it's a welcome sight that we're going to continue to at least have energy in the mix and, again, beneficial for the banks.
Yeah, because one of the things that the Fed has been trying to do is encourage credit creation. And if we look at year over year, money supply growth is up a little over 8%. So when you have a steepening yield curve, as you do now, there's an incentive for banks to make loans. And if they start making loans or making loans more readily available, we know that expands the economy. I want to talk about what is happening. We've seen this rotation and we've seen this big surge in stock prices as well as interest rates. A lot of this is based on, in my opinion, Dave, there was a lot of money that was sitting on the sidelines heading into the election because nobody was sure what was going to be the outcome. Now we know what the outcome is. We also know explicitly the game plan of the Trump administration. They want to lower taxes. They want to get rid of regulations. They want to increase infrastructure spending. So in your opinion, as you watch and look at money flows, how much of this is those bets are now being made when the election outcome is certain?
Yeah, I think the market got caught off sides initially, you know, with a majority of news outlets suggesting that, you know, a Trump win would usher in, you know, a surge in gold and a market drop, you know, depending on what media outlet you looked at, you know, some were looking for a 15 to 20% drop. And I think it just absolutely caught everyone by surprise that those participants that saw the Trump win come, and, you know, if you looked at the futures, you know, prior to the open that morning, you know, one of the things that stood out was, you know, the Dow was down roughly, you know, 680 points at one point. And by the market open, we had reversed and went positive. And I think you saw a significant amount of short covering along with, you know, what I think many expected would be no decision coming out of OPEC. And that certainly caught, I think, the world by surprise. And, you know, they were forced to sell some of their tech stocks. I think those that were short energy were forced to sell what had been working and rotate back into energy or at least cover their short. So I think everything that we're seeing from the market would certainly suggest that, you know, we are still within the confines of a bull market. And these surprises coming in the form of sector rotations are very powerful and can literally leave you in the dust if you don't act on them or at least attempt to, you know, find those sectors where the charts are still intact.
As I look at the year-to-date returns, we've seen a tremendous increase in small cap stocks. You had the S&P 500, mid-cap 400, the 600, the Russell 2000 are really doing well. Is this a reflection of the dollar? Is this a reflection of value? What are you seeing here as you see these indexes really start to outperform? I take a look at where the Russell 2000 is. It's up over 15%. You look at the S&P 600. It's up close to 20% for the year. So it seems like small cap stocks are leading the pack here.
Absolutely. And I think that's a confidence indicator in the U.S. market, and especially in small business, where you don't have as much distortion regarding a strong currency. I think that's overwhelming evidence that, you know, the economy is actually going to pick up, and we're going to see some changes in fiscal policy that we really haven't seen for quite some time. And I think that the market and investors and business owners are very warm to the idea of at least seeing some tax cuts.
Let's talk about a couple things that could help the S&P. We know if the energy and materials sector, which has been a drag on earnings, if that starts to increase, that could boost earnings and give us something that we haven't seen. And also, what about repatriation? You know, there's what, I forget, several trillion dollars overseas. Both the Republican plan and the Trump plan talk about a tax rate of 10% to 8.5%. If that money comes back, it's estimated a good portion of it, if we look historically what happened when Bush did the same thing in 2003 and 2004, a lot of that money went into buybacks and dividends. Could that be a stimulus for stock prices going higher?
Absolutely. And I think that you're going to see a lot of mergers and acquisitions take place with that money coming back as well. I think majority of businesses out there, especially in the large cap arena that have international exposure, are looking to really look for competitors or someone that's smaller that they can take over and, you know, add to the bottom line. And I think this would certainly drive the M&A market significantly.
So as you look at the sector rotation that we've seen taking place, you know, it's obvious Trump wants to lower taxes. He wants to rebuild defense. He wants to rebuild infrastructure spending. He's talking about $1 trillion, public and private, over 10 years. Are you seeing that play out in terms of sector rotation and what's doing well right now?
Absolutely. You know, especially in the manufacturing sector, which has seen a significant advance since the election has taken place. I think there's concrete evidence that the market is totally warming up to that thought process. Again, we won't know until, you know, we see more action, but the market certainly is anticipating it. You know, I don't like to go against the market. I think the ballots are being cast in what direction Trump is going to go, and I wouldn't go against that voting mechanism. As we know, those things that we think we all know, we really don't. So I think that we have to look at this and look for opportunities to get into the names if you don't already own them. But I think the infrastructure names are going to do quite well for quite some period of time.
So, Dave, when you take a look at this, I mean, a lot of this is maybe some say is getting ahead of the game, because we all know that, as we saw in the stimulus package in 2009, we know as legislation goes through the sausage factory in Congress with various interest groups, various parties, it could take some time to get a bill passed. And then secondly, we know from infrastructure projects or projects that are shovel ready, it could be maybe a year before actually money gets put into the economy and starts to work its way with these infrastructure projects. So is the market getting ahead of itself in terms of when the stimulus is taking place? And secondly, could you see a possible drawback to the stimulus if the Fed gets aggressive on, let's say, raising interest rates because they perceive inflation is rising and the economy is improving?
Yeah, I don't think we'll have as much concern about the inflationary aspect at this point in time, especially with the dollar remaining strong. I would be more concerned about energy advancing, you know, significantly in a short period of time. Last time I was on your show, I talked about that we are truly in a bond bubble. And I think that, you know, since the election, you've seen about $1.7 trillion be wiped out of the market in terms of the bond market. And I think, again, when we looking forward, we probably have advanced to a level in many of those areas in terms of when the rubber meets the road on infrastructure spending. But I think that, again, you have to look for opportunities on pullbacks within those areas, whether it's the engineering and construction, some of the manufacturing stocks. I think that the Fed is going to be patient, and you're going to see some rate hikes along the way. But I don't think that snuffs us out of gas to push this market higher. In fact, I think that we need to get to some normalization in interest rates, and I think it would be a welcome sight if the market can certainly hold up. I don't want to see rates advance significantly from here. We're right now on a 12-month rate of change basis. We're as overbought as we have seen in almost 20 years in the bond market. So, again, I think we need some consolidation. I think we need to see some money come back into utilities and staples. But I don't expect them to be long-term leadership. I think they can just get a bounce from here. I don't think it's going to be a long-lived bounce. But, again, I think it's opportunity for those that are looking to get some degree of exposure to higher interest rates. But I do expect that over time, they will continue to underperform.
Could we be in a situation, and I think back, Dave, going back to, let's say, 2013, when they announced the taper, and we had the taper tantrum, we saw the long bond go from 1.6 to 3% in a six-month period of time. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe that in July of this year, the 10-year Treasury note was at 1.32, and on Thursday, we're doing this interview on Friday, the 10-year Treasury note got almost to 2.5%. So, is that overextended, as you just pointed out? Maybe we pull back just like we did in 2015 or 2014 when you saw rates come down when everybody thought they were going up.
Yeah, I think we've seen the ultimate low in rates. And I think in the near term, we've got to see some pullback. And we could probably see something come back into the 2.2% area. And I think that would be a safe area which to lighten your bonds again. But again, I think this is a time issue. You just don't want to burst this bond market bubble that's been brewing for 30 years. You don't want to pop it significantly. You do need to see some rotation out of it, and hopefully it's in a slow, measured rate by investors. Any bubble is very difficult to determine the action and how fast the velocity is of exiting. And again, I think we're still in that bond bubble, but again, hopefully this one can be done over time rather than a complete reversal so that we see rates, you know, move up 200 to 300 basis points within a six-month period. I don't want to see that. I think that would send shockwaves to the equity market.
Yeah, because we saw this in 2013. The stock market had an excellent year, even though rates were rising, but then things reversed themselves. I don't think investors, and let's talk about the implications for this, because if you're in individual bonds and they're laddered, you have less of a worry. Your bonds mature, you get your money back. But if you're in a bond fund and we're in a rate-raising cycle or interest rate cycle that is going to rise over time, which I think it is. I mean, I just take a look at TLT in July of this year, that ETF was up close to 20%. Most of those gains have been given back in the last couple months. So are there risks to individual investors? Because as you and I know, Dave, since 2009, a vast majority of individual investors' money has gone into either cash or it's gone into bond funds. What are the risks to investors going forward if they are heavily invested in bond funds?
Yeah, I think the risk is that they're going to continue to see rates rise, and I think that's going to put a damper on their enthusiasm to buy more bonds. You know, if the market does have a dramatic drop, first thing that money is going to flee to in terms of safety is going to be obviously interest rate bearing instruments, but we still have a great unwinding to do, and I think that with what you're going to see in terms of fiscal policy, I think that the growth is going to be much better owning equities over the long term from here. I do think that we are emerging, and I'm seeing it in at least many international markets. Japan has, you know, by far the most bullish charts I've seen in their market in 25 years that I've been doing technical analysis. And I think you've seen the cross between the currencies of the U.S. dollar and the Japanese yen, and a majority of their stocks are breaking out to, you know, 19, 20-year highs, 20-year bases, and significant relative strength downtrend reversals. So I think what we're going to see all around here, Jim, is that we're going to see the emerging markets are still going to do well over the long term. I think we've made the bottoms and had their pullbacks recently in the market. I think the U.S. market dominated in terms of the spotlight after the election. I would imagine that we'll see some type of consolidation of these gains, and I would look back to the emerging markets as evidence if money's going to come back and put investors on a risk on appetite.
And could we see something, you know, they've talked about it. It was certainly mentioned in 2013 and also in the subsequent years about the Fed leaning more towards tightening, that there would be eventually a rotation out of bonds into equities that would drive the final leg of the bull market. It hasn't happened yet. I looked at fund flows this year. The vast majority of money has gone still into bond funds, and money has flowed out of equity funds. So could you see, if these rates continue to rise as investors in bond funds experience losses, that we finally get the great rotation?
I think we've started the great rotation, but it's coming in the form of sector rotation rather than overall equities. And one example of that, in a true bull market, you would hope that even staples and utilities would move up. But again, you can't move them up in a higher interest rate environment. It would be nice to see more positive action within the form of consumer discretionary and the transports. I think that would give us the added conviction that that's perhaps the last two sectors that one would look at to see how strong the internal economy is for the consumer. I would like to see those advance, and I think that could be the final lift to take us off to new highs again and consolidate, again, some of the gains in the other sectors that have had monstrous moves. We've been overweight materials, energy, manufacturing, and financials and technology for the last 5-6 months, and again, I continue to like them. I just need to see some consolidation in them.
All right. So given this sudden run-up, Dave, that we've seen not only the rise in interest rates, we've seen the rise in stock prices, would you be waiting for a pullback here, or do you think this rally has legs to carry it through to the end of the year with the Santa Claus rally?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that we have room to continue in a northbound direction, but I'm going to have to step back and say, one of the things that I think many investors look at is they look at the major indices, whether it's the S&P 500, 600, or 400. In reality, as a technician that does a lot of sector work, most of your gains are found at the sector level and not in the overall market. And great examples, when you look back at over time and throughout my database, would indicate that when you look at the average deviation from the best sector to the worst sector from 1970 to present, or through 2013 is the last time I calculated, was a 45% deviation on average on a given calendar year between the best sector and the worst sector. The second best sector and the second worst sector had a deviation of 26% on average. Again, looking at the major indices does not give you the full story about what's happening underneath it. And I think it's important to look at sector rotations and look what sectors are not performing and find the reasons why they're not. In terms of answering your question from an index level, I have difficulty believing that we aren't going to consolidate here, but I also believe that the bull market actually remains intact. And again, the evidence that I want to see that the consumer is doing much better, being 70% of the economy, I'd like to see much more positive action and bullish breakouts within the confines of the consumer discretionary and transports. Transports, we did move up to an overweight about 2 months ago. I'm seeing better charts there. Again, I don't want to see energy move too far too fast because I think you could take the wind out of both of those sectors. And I think perhaps with the new administration looking at the Affordable Care Act and backing off some of that, I think it will be much better for the consumer to do that. So those are the telltale signs that I'm watching for. And I think that's a high possibility that those will start to consolidate and move higher.
If there's anything that could happen negatively that would disrupt this bullish trend, in your opinion, what would that be?
I think the biggest concerns I have in the market is just how fast the bond market unwinds, as well as how far energy advances, because there's a certain equilibrium that you want energy to be at, and we'll begin to know what that level is as energy prices keep climbing. The market will have a tendency to drift off at some point. Right now, I think it's moving up because of the cut, but I think it's also looking at the prospects of growth around the globe, since it is an international product. I think it's interesting that, the dollar has remained strong, even with oil advancing close to, 18-month highs or year highs. Natural gas was breaking out to 18-month highs. And what that tells me is it's actually being driven by growth as well, and the dollar is not being impacted, or at least not reversing to the downside, despite the rising commodity prices. I think gold is sold off, and when you look at some of the RSI indications on it, it does indicate that we are getting divergences here and likely should see some type of rally, and that would be a confirmation that, the end of deflation is taking place, and I think that would be a good sign.
Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do, because you do a lot of extensive work, not only here in sectors, but also overseas, how could they do that?
Yes, our website is at vermilioncap.com, one L in Vermilion, or they can also call us at 952-922-7000. 7500.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
2017 is likely going to be a very momentous year, not just because of a new U.S. president who has a radically different agenda than his predecessor, but also because of some major changes that we're going to see in the EU and also in various parts of the globe. Joining us on the show today is Reva Gojan. She's the Vice President of Global Analysis at Stratfor. And Reva, when you look at the prediction markets, the forecasting models, the polling data, it's pretty clear that the experts never imagined that Trump would make it as far as he did, and certainly never really ever become president. So, you know, many are referring to this as a major upset, as a shock vote. And, you know, we saw the same thing take place in the UK when citizens there voted to leave the EU. The consensus thinking was that it would not happen. And if it did happen, it would be a major travesty. Of course, we did see it happen and markets responded positively, just like we saw with Trump as well. But I want to ask you, from Stratfor's perspective, do you think people are overreaching by linking these two quote-unquote shock events together? Or do you think that this is really the beginning of a major shift and turning point that's going to continue to play out across the world stage?
Well, definitely more of the latter. I think this is very much a systemic shift that we're seeing in the international system, and the politics that may be shocking to many people is really just a manifestation of something much deeper going on there. And what's going on is when you look at these bigger forces, so we've seen slower economic growth overall. If you look at global trade growth figures, we've seen global trade basically plateau in 2015. And this is a protracted slump, which tells you that something bigger is going on there. And then you look at why, and you look at aging demographics, and you look at technological advancements and labor displacements, and how that combined with immigration all together drives a rise in nationalism, in protectionism, populism, nativism. All of the isms, right, really come to the fore in the developed world. And this is not a temporary blip. This is something that is going to endure, and it's going to have second and third order effects that are going to reshape the international system. So this is something that, you know, the whole world is going to be adjusting to. And it's, you know, things that have been creeping up where, you know, we talk about demographics very abstractly, right? But we're getting closer and closer to the 2030s, to the 2040s, where a lot of developed countries who have seen contracting populations over time, that's when they really start to feel that crunch. And as these populations grow older and as economic growth slows, as labor productivity declines, you know, that all is going to have a tremendous impact.
Well, this week, OPEC met, and for once, they agreed on something. They're cutting production, and boy, what a surprise in the price of oil. We've got oil prices back over $50 a barrel. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, I'd like to get your take on this meeting with OPEC. How significant was it? Because a lot of people say they're less effective today than they used to be as a result of U.S. shale production. That was number one. And number two, they've often had deals in the past, but nobody adhered to the deal. In other words, they would cheat. So how strong of a deal is this? Do you think they'll hold it up? And let's talk about the significance of this, because now we have not only rising oil prices, but we also have rising interest rates.
Yeah, so it's a very significant move, and it's very significant because it signals a shift in strategy. You know, just to review, what happened a couple of years ago, shale producers had put about 5 million barrels a day of oil on the market after the shale revolution started. And OPEC still produced, you know, 42% of the world's oil, and it saw its market share erode just a little bit. But in my view, they were probably looking back at what happened after the 1973 oil embargo, where they really lost a lot of market share. And 2 years ago, they decided they were going to be proactive. And instead of making cuts to balance the market, they decided they were going to defend market share. And I think what they thought was they would put a little bit more oil on the market and the price would fall. At the time, it had already dropped from about 100 to about 75 or 80. And I think they probably thought it could fall to maybe 60 or 50, and it would put all the shale guys out of business, take all that oil off the market, and they would be back in control. And instead, what happened was the oil production in the U.S. declined much more slowly than they thought it was going to. Only about 1 million barrels came off the market over 2 years, and OPEC crashed the price of oil. And because shale didn't come off as fast as they thought it would, we've had soft oil prices ever since. And so that's been 2 years ago that they embarked on that strategy. And if you listen to Saudi Arabia, generally they get what they want within OPEC. And recently they started signaling that maybe it was time to reverse course here. They'd had members like Venezuela and Nigeria all along saying, we think this is not the way to go. We want to go ahead and cut production. We think that's the way to go. And Saudi recently started saying that. So if you know Saudi's power within OPEC, then it was kind of obvious that this cut was likely to happen. Even as the OPEC meeting leading up to it, there were signs that they're not going to agree. But Saudi clearly was thinking, you know, we need a shift in direction. The reason this is so significant, yes, there will be cheating, and yes, things will happen. Oil is not going to go up in a straight line here, but it signals a strategy shift. And a strategy shift within OPEC will last for some years. So I think we will see now some years of OPEC trying to defend price. And it may mean a couple of cuts, because what's going to happen is they will cut, oil prices will go up a little bit, shale oil production will go up a little bit. OPEC might find that they have to cut again. And that was their original calculation is, you know, we just cut and all we're doing is propping up the shale guys. And so that's their fear right now. So the question is, how much can shale producers really ramp up production relative to how much OPEC is willing to cut? OPEC, again, they still produce more than 40% of the world's oil. So they have a very commanding share of global oil markets. So I think what we'll see now, and, you know, I've seen people call OPEC again and again a paper tiger. And I said, you know, the reason oil prices fell to $20 is because OPEC put 2 million barrels of oil on top of an oversupplied market. They moved oil prices down tremendously. And now, with just making this announcement, they've moved the price of oil, the largest globally traded commodity, they've moved it up 15% in just a couple of days. Who else has that kind of power to move markets like that? So I think we're going to see a real strategy shift here. I think we're going to see that the energy markets are going to look much better in the years ahead now.
Robert, I want to talk about the significance of this. As you mentioned, they're going to cut 1.2 million barrels. You've got Iran in there, which is basically their view all along is, look, as a result of sanctions, we lost significant market share, and we're not going to stop producing until we get back up to 4 million barrels a day or whatever the number was before sanctions kicked in. So you've got Iran increasing its production. You've got Iraq increasing its production because it's in fighting an internal civil war within the state itself. Who effectively is going to do the majority of the cuts? Is it going to be Saudi Arabia? Is it going to be Russia? Or is it going to be what is commonly referred to as the Gulfies?
Yeah, Saudi has taken 40% of the cuts. So the bulk is going to fall on Saudi. You know, they are the largest producer within OPEC. I think they stepped up and said, listen, we're willing to bear the biggest burden, but we need a lot of you to step up here. And they've done it. You know, I think it was Nigeria and Libya that are exempted from the cuts. But, you know, everyone else within OPEC, even Iran, has some quota that was put on them. And, you know, if they look, OPEC sees what's happening with oil prices today, and they know the consequences of cheating and of overproducing. And so, you know, the market's sending them a very strong message right now to get on board here with the program and, you know, make the cuts that they've agreed to make.
Yeah, because there's been a lot of arguments. You've got Venezuela, which is really strapped for cash, and many OPEC nations are strapped for cash, including Saudi Arabia. They had to tap the debt markets. They've gone through a significant amount of their currency reserves. So when you look at this, you would think that there would be finally some consensus. And I think that's what you're implying here. Look, if we cheat, if we keep producing for market share, all we're going to end up doing is producing more of the stuff and getting paid less for it. Wouldn't it make a lot more sense if you got an oversupplied market? Because that's what we would do here in the West. A Western oil company, if it was selling a product that was oversupplied, would cut back on its production.
Exactly. I mean, you know, what happened a couple of years ago, they put, I don't know, maybe 5% more oil on the market and cut the price in half. So, you know, certainly that wasn't worth it. And here they may be able to take off 5% and get the price, you know, 30, 40% higher. More cash in hand. If they can agree and will restrict production among themselves, even though it will benefit the shale producers, and they know that. Again, that's why they made the decision a couple of years ago in the first place. But it costs them a lot of money. So, as I've said, you know, it's not about fairness. OPEC came out then and said, you know, it's not fair that we cut production. We're the low-cost producer. You know, in any kind of rational market, the high-cost producer should go out of business. And that's true, but it's going to cost them money. There are consequences for making that decision. Even though they prop up higher-cost producers, they're going to crash the price if they dump that oil on the market, which they did. And I think they've learned a lesson. They burned through a lot of cash reserves. And, you know, you've got Venezuela teetering on the brink of collapse as a result of the collapse in oil prices. So I think there are very, very strong signals the market's sending them right now to, hey, get on board with these cuts and maintain discipline.
I want to bring another dimension into the oil markets, and that is, you know, their initial calculation is they would drive out the high-cost producers, in this case, U.S. shale. I think what they found, at least my interpretation of what they found, Robert, is U.S. companies are innovative. The cost of producing shale has gone down. So the drop in U.S. production did not go down as much as they thought it was going to go. And there were a lot of shale producers and companies in the oil business that had to keep producing anyway because they had to service debt payments.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that this morning. Really, all they did, they weeded out the 10% highest cost producers, and they forced everyone else to get much more efficient. So, you know, the U.S. shale industry is a more efficient, stronger, lower cost industry than it was because OPEC made the decision 2 years ago that they made. And, you know, I've argued many times that it was a $1 trillion miscalculation on their part. It's going to cost them $1 trillion in foregone revenue in making the decision they made. I understand why they made it, but I don't agree that it was the right decision. And I think now they're saying it wasn't.
I want to bring up another dimension to the price of oil, because as you and I know, Robert, there's more to the price of oil than just supply and demand. Oil also has a political dimension. And one of these is the election of President-elect Donald Trump, because we had the Iranian deal that President Barack Obama put into effect. He lifted sanctions. Iran has been able to increase its production significantly. But what could be the possibility of Trump tearing up the nuclear agreement with Iran and removing almost 1 million barrels a day of supply at just a stroke of a pen? Because the deal with Iran was not a ratified treaty by the Senate. And at least Trump, in his campaign, said he thought that was one of the worst deals out there. What's the other possibility that once he assumes office, that he reverses the Iranian deal? That could take, what, another 1 million barrels off the market as well?
It could, and that is a real risk to the oil markets. You know, it could push oil prices higher. But I think then you might see OPEC reverse their decision to cut production. So Saudi, instead of cutting 300,000 or whatever barrels, would not do that. And then Russia would not cut the 300,000 that they agreed to cut. And you'd see most of that made up. But, you know, it would be bullish for oil prices. You know, it's hard to say what he's going to do. But if he does tear up that agreement, I think it's overall bullish, but maybe not as bullish as taking 1 million barrels a day off the market, because there are other OPEC members that would like to step into that void.
All right. So we've got the price of oil over $50 a barrel. They're going to cut production. And as you and I mentioned, we will probably see an increase in production coming from U.S. shale producers, especially if it remains over 50. Let's talk about stockpiles, because in a recent Bloomberg report, they talk about, for example, the various pads where storage is building. Pad 1 is at 81% utilization. Pad number 2 is at 50% capacity. Cushing is at 77. What about the supply of oil? How much does that dampen the price of oil and its capability of rising further?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole deal. I mean, if you read the announcement OPEC made, they said that they could see the market was going to balance next year, but they were concerned that inventories are still very high. And so they said that is the reason they're going to take oil off the market, is to try to bring the inventories down. And I've always warned that that was the risk that's providing headwinds for oil prices, is the very high inventory levels. So even though you can look ahead and you can see, yes, the market will be in balance, now in the second half of next year, I think we're going to see significant balance in the oil market, whereas it looked like it was probably going to be second half of the year. I think you'll see inventories coming down in earnest a lot sooner than they were going to. And that was OPEC's justification for making this decision, is we still have very high global inventories.
So, you know, they were predicting originally when this decision was initially made in, what was it, November of 2014, when the price of oil was over $100 a barrel, they thought the oil markets would come into balance in 2016. We know that's not the case. When do you see this? Is this a second half story for 2017, or is it a 2018 story?
I think it was a second half 2017 story, and now it becomes a first half 2017 story. I think, you know, OPEC is going to take that production off the market on January 1st, and I think the market was probably oversupplied by about that much or somewhere in that vicinity. So I think we will start to see inventories come down in the first half of the year. And as that happens in earnest, I think oil prices will start to creep higher. I think OPEC is saying, look, we've had enough of $40 and $50 oil, and we're going to do what we have to do to make sure that price doesn't happen again. So I think their decision here takes a lot of the downside risk out of oil prices. You know, I think even if some of them cheat, you know, the proxy for oil demand and oil supply is still inventories. We can still see what's going on with inventories. And if inventories are not going down, I think you'll see, you know, OPEC decide to cut more until it's clear inventories are going down, because that's going to really provide a floor for oil prices. When inventories are going down, the downside risk has been really de-risked.
So, Robert, where do we go? If you take the last 12 months, we've been a trading range between $40 and $50 a barrel. Do we go to $50 to $60 a barrel, or do they want the price of oil higher than that?
I think they'd like to see the price of oil higher than that. I think they'd probably like to get it back to, you know, at least the $70 range. I think that would make a lot of them happy. So I think we will see 60. You know, one of my January predictions was $60 oil this year, and I've kind of written that off. But, you know, at the time I made that prediction, we were in the 30s. And I said, you know, I'd give myself a B on this prediction if we made it to 50 this year. And now I think we've got a chance to make it to 60. And the more that happens, the more OPEC sees still how much power they have in moving the markets, I think the more resolve and discipline they will have in sticking with the program here and sticking together and seeing that, you know, what's good for one of us is good for all of us. So I really think this is a seismic shift in the oil markets that hasn't taken place in a very long time. It's a big deal.
Let me throw a wild card out here. Since Trump's election, you've seen the price of oil go up on speculation that OPEC was going to cut, which they did this week. You also have interest rates rising on the idea that Trump is going to be reflationary for the U.S. economy. We had the 10-year Treasury, which got down to about 1.3% during the summer after Brexit. And on the day you and I are speaking, it's almost at 2.5%, and it looks like it's still rising. What happens if, let's say, we get to your price of $60 oil? For the American consumer out there that saw oil prices at $26 a barrel, now looking at $60 a barrel, and for interest rates that were below 1.5%, going their way to 3%, those are two significant headwinds for the economy. What happens, Robert, if economic growth begins to slow down as a result of two things? Rising oil prices and its inflationary effects, and rising interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And I've always said that as long as the U.S. is a net importer of oil, oil prices going up are not good for the overall economy. They're definitely good for the oil industry, and the oil industry does employ a lot of people. But overall, I mean, gasoline futures, I believe, were up 11 cents a gallon yesterday. So you're going to see effect at the pump very quickly. It is going to be like a stealth tax on people. They're going to have less leftover income, discretionary income, to go out and do things with. So as long as we're a net oil importer, that is going to be the case. the beneficiaries, the big beneficiaries, are those big net oil exporters. But, you know, cash is going to flow out of the United States toward Saudi Arabia, toward Russia, and toward those countries. They're the ones that will really benefit. Now, if we didn't produce any oil at all, it would be, you know, much more devastating. But, you know, given that we do produce a lot of oil and our net import position has been declining over the past few years, it's not overall as bad as it would have been, say, 10 years ago. It's going to put a lot of people back to work in the oil industry. So, you know, there are good sides and downsides. But overall, for the economy, it's probably a net negative.
So, given the fact that you expect oil prices, with the possibility that we may hit $60 a barrel, who is best situated, as you look at the oil sector, to take advantage of these rising prices? Are they the U.S., mid-cap, smaller companies that are in major shale plays? Is it the large-cap international companies that are more diverse? Who would be best able to take advantage of these rising prices if you were to make an investment decision here?
Yeah, I think the market spoke yesterday. And ironically, on Monday, we put out a buy notification to subscribers, and we told them to buy Whiting and buy Continental Resources on Monday. And on Tuesday, OPEC made this announcement, and Whiting was up 30% and Continental went up 23%, and Whiting's up another 4% today. So those are shale plays. In fact, I read that Harold Hamm made $3 billion yesterday with the big move up in Continental Resources. Those are the guys that are going to benefit a lot. EOG Resources, which I hold, it's been up sharply the last couple of days. You know, even ConocoPhillips, you know, they have shale plays, but they're a global producer. They moved up 10% yesterday, but they're not going to be as significant a movers. The real big winners are going to be, you know, the shale guys who are sort of, some of them, like EOG, is moving toward a cash neutral position at $40, $50 oil. Those are the guys that are going to do very well now. I mean, they've become more efficient. You know, small players like Oasis and the Bakken, all the guys that are really concentrated in the shale plays will be the ones to benefit the most. The midstream guys will benefit. The refiners are going to get hurt here. So, you know, I'd watch your refiners. Valero's been down 2 days in a row now as a result of the news. It's still a really good company, but they're going to be paying more for oil now. And generally, when oil prices are rising, refiners' margins erode. And so I think you'll see that now. You know, what's good for the oil companies is usually not good for the refiners. And of course, the big integrated companies are somewhere in between because they produce oil. They also refine oil. So their downstream segment's going to get hit some, while their upstream segment will benefit.
Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, there are several places they could do so. Why don't you tell them how they can do so?
Absolutely, Jim. I write a weekly column for Forbes, and I'll actually have two columns up this week on the news with OPEC. I have published a column this morning describing that situation. And then I write two weekly columns for Investing Daily, and then one subscription column that comes out biweekly for Investing Daily. And those are the main places that you can find my work.
Every president is going to be tested. We can assume that will be true of Mr. Trump, especially by countries such as China and Russia on the geopolitical scene of things. They're calling it the Trumpian Revolution. And not only will he be tested there, but also the conditions economically when he's coming into office are markedly different than they were when Mr. Bush took office and when President Obama took office. So will the Trumpian Revolution actually succeed in the directions in which it wishes to go, especially economically? And if that's the case, then what does that mean for investments? All of that, the subject of discussion coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.